content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are in our second broadcast, reading from the June 15, 2015 issue of The Week magazine. And we'll start this session with an article from Ireland. Choosing Gay Rights Over Catholic Values. The Catholic Church has lost its grip on the Irish, said Paul Valley in The Independent on Sunday from the UK. A solid 62% of voters chose last week to legalize gay marriage, making Ireland the first country to do so by national referendum. What a stunning transformation from the Ireland of just 3 decades ago when voters refused to legalize divorce. That Ireland was the nearest thing Europe had to a theocracy, with the Catholic Church running the school system and weekly mass all but mandatory. Since then, though, the Church's moral authority has been wrecked by revelations of widespread sexual abuse of children by priests and regimes of physical and psychological cruelty at church-run orphanages and homes for unwed mothers. The Irish people have changed, too. As Ireland grew rich during the Celtic Tiger boom, Ireland's best and brightest no longer immigrated but stayed home and fostered change. Many Irish people now call themselves post-Catholic. That term applies to the country, too. Ireland has shown its true face, said the Irish Times in an editorial. Modern Ireland is a young, networked society. The youth vote turned out in full strength, accompanied by many young emigres who came home from specifically to cast their ballots. The Irish have shed the intolerance of the past and given our LGBT citizens the most emphatic affirmation of acceptance. The Irish people's innate sense of decency and generosity has won out. What a smug little narrative, said Brendan O'Neill in the Irish Independent on Sunday. Ireland is gloating that it has broken free of its dark, intolerant past and emerged blinking into the light of gay-friendly, rainbow-hued 21st century. In fact, it has simply swapped one kind of intolerance for another. The Yes campaign for gay marriage was marked by hostility to dissent and demonization of its opponents. Supporters of the No campaign were treated in the same way old Ireland might have treated teen fornicators or godless boozers, pariahs with no place among the decent. While old Ireland called non-believers sinners, New Ireland smears dissenters from its orthodoxy as bigots. The No voters deserve to be carefully listened to, said the Irish Independent. Difficult issues surround surrogacy and assisted reproduction remain to be dealt with by legislation, and Catholic bishops and other church members can make strong contributions in those debates. But let's be clear why the Yes campaign won the victory. It was about the stories. The Irish are a storytelling people, and gay marriage supporters brought us heart-wrenching narratives of exclusion, fear, loneliness, and unhappiness. We heard from mothers anguished for their gay children and children pleading for recognition for their gay parents. By talking and listening to each other, we have come together to sweep away a long-standing injustice. We'll look at a few columns now, the first two from Europe, this from the Netherlands, Rutger Bregman, Everyone Deserves the Basics. In a rich society like ours, everyone should live comfortably, said Rutger Bregman. Classical economists tend to be aghast at the idea of guaranteeing every citizen a basic income. They wrongly assume that if you hand people free money, they will immediately stop working. In fact, research by the World Bank shows that people work more effectively after they have been lifted out of poverty. Here in the Netherlands, many people have no incentive to get off the dole because a minimum wage job often pays less than unemployment benefits. With a guaranteed income, there's no such trap. Work always pays, even for those who remain jobless. The program would more than pay for itself at a societal level when you count the billions saved on health care, policing, and bureaucracy. This is an important point because our economy does not have enough vacant jobs for everyone who wants to work. And as robotics and software evolve, there will be even fewer jobs for humans. Rather than simply humiliating and patronizing the unemployed, we could encourage them to do volunteer work with children or seniors or beautify our parks. Almost everyone wants to make something of his life and contribute to society. A basic income can make that possible. This one from the United Kingdom. The author is Amit Singh from The Independent. Labor is no longer for workers. Many pundits have proclaimed the Labor Party's epic meltdown in the recent election evidence of the left's irreversible demise, said Amit Singh. But they are quite wrong. The Labor Party is not a leftist party and hasn't been for many years. Labor leader Ed Miliband, who resigned in disgrace after his party lost 26 seats, didn't even try to offer a debate on the merits of immigration. Instead, he capitulated to the far right, promising stricter controls on who gets in and who stays. But the party's desertion of its socialist roots didn't start with Miliband. Labor under Tony Blair took us in an imperialist war in Iraq based on ginned-up intelligence, and it was responsible for repealing people's civil liberties in the aftermath of 9/11 and the 2005 London bombings. Under Gordon Brown, Labor used public money to bail out huge tax-avoiding banks. This is not a progressive agenda. Sure, the party may be marginally less awful than the ruling conservatives, but the difference is so slight as to be almost meaningless. To coo over them and think they'll actually improve the UK for the working class is delusional. The party is pro-business, pro-austerity, pro-war, and definitely not pro-ordinary people. From Australia, Hugh White at the Sydney Morning Herald, caught between the U.S. and China. Australian leaders refuse to acknowledge the plain fact that the U.S. and China are strategic rivals, said Hugh White, when a Pentagon official recently told the U.S. Congress that American B-1 bombers would soon be stationed in Australia to check China's growing assertiveness in the South China Sea. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott was embarrassed and angry. Eager to placate China, our largest trade partner, he insisted that the U.S.-Australia alliance was not directed against anyone. That's obviously untrue, since the U.S. military realignment known as the Pivot to Asia is explicitly intended to contain China. For Abbott to say otherwise is either astonishingly naive or downright dishonest. China's economic might now rivals America's, and Beijing will no longer accept Washington calling the shots in the Pacific. The Americans are girding themselves for a tough and bruising contest with China, and they expect their Australian ally to stand with them. Obviously, we don't want to get drawn into a military showdown in our own backyard. But to avoid that, we will have to talk to Washington about a more effective and realistic response to China's challenge to U.S. leadership in Asia. Continuing to ignore the issue won't make it go away. From Russia, Natalia Antonova at the Moscow Times writes, Chechnya's repression is now ours. Russia has a patriarchy problem, said Natalia Antonova. A 17-year-old Chechen girl was recently forced to become the second wife of a powerful Chechen police officer some 40 years her senior. The marriage was doubly illegal, violating bans on bigamy and on underage marriage. Russians can't legally wed until they're 18. But the Kremlin refused to comment. Loath to upset its ally, Chechen warlord Ramzan Kadyrov. Some Russian officials actually expressed approval of the blessed nuptials. Many ordinary Russians, meanwhile, are horrified. Yet while they complain about the marriage on social media, they haven't taken to the streets in protest or demanded the girl's freedom. Instead, there's a collective shrug, as if what happens in Chechnya had no bearing on other Russian regions. Such a view is dangerously short-sighted. Chechen attitudes are increasingly becoming Russian government attitudes. Kadyrov crushed dissent in Chechnya, and now dissent is being crushed across Russia. The Chechen patriarchal attitude toward women could also find resonance. Russians are encouraged to side with power and disdain the weak, which includes low-status women. Think a forced marriage couldn't happen elsewhere in Russia? Think again. On the business page, the issue of the week is the push for a $15 minimum wage. Labor activists just won a landmark victory in America's second largest city, said Rory Carroll at The Guardian. The Los Angeles City Council voted 14-1 last week to raise the city's minimum wage from $9 to $15 per hour by 2020. Seattle and San Francisco have recently made similar moves and will enact the $15 minimum wage by 2017 and 2018, respectively. Now, organizers of the LA wage campaign hope to create a domino effect, bringing the fight for higher pay to cities around the country, including New York City, Chicago, and Washington, D.C. Activists won't like to hear it, but this wage hike will hurt workers, said Megan McArdle in BloombergView.com. I'm not saying businesses will shut their doors en masse or start laying off staff, but over time, employers will decide not to add workers. Struggling firms will slip into the red, and bosses will look to reduce headcounts by investing in labor-saving technology, like touchscreen stations for customers to do their own ordering. It won't happen overnight, but ultimately there will be fewer employees in some businesses as a result of this hike. I firmly believe that any person willing to work should be able to make a decent living, said Warren Buffett in the Wall Street Journal. But minimum wage hikes only leave workers behind by reducing employment in a major way. Instead, we should increase and improve the earned income tax credit, which supports low-income workers but doesn't distort the market by damaging employment or discouraging work. Please spare me the tut-tutting, said Jeff Spross in TheWeek.com. Our society rigorously enforces the notion that everyone has a moral obligation to work. But we then refuse to require that employers pay wages that people can actually live on. That's as clear a recipe for worker exploitation as one could possibly imagine. Opponents of higher mandated wages insist that the higher pay will lead to layoffs and business closings, said the New York Times in an editorial. But those are the same tired arguments that have been trotted out since 1938, when the minimum wage was first introduced. Experience and research prove the critics wrong. Higher costs to employers are offset by lower turnover and higher productivity. And with the long phase-in of these recent laws, employers have plenty of time to prepare. The truth is, we don't know what the effect of a $15 minimum wage will be, said Jordan Weissman in Slate.com. Cities have never attempted hikes of this magnitude before. Previous studies that indicate wage increases don't have much impact on employment have all looked at moderately sized increases. And now other cities are poised to jump on the bandwagon before we know what the results of this big test will be. Cities like Los Angeles aren't just defying decades of economic orthodoxy, said John Cassidy in The New Yorker. They are also challenging the idea that low-wage jobs are unavoidable and acceptable. If the city's wage experiment can prove the critics wrong, it could change American politics in a very significant way. We'll read two obituaries this week. The first, the troubled mathematician who inspired a beautiful mind, John Nash, 1928 to 2015. During the 1960s and 70s, students at Princeton grew accustomed to seeing a disheveled, barefoot man roaming through the math building, muttering to himself and scribbling nonsensical equations on blackboards. What few outside the faculty knew was this man was John Nash, one of the greatest mathematicians of his generation. As depicted in the hit 2001 Hollywood film A Beautiful Mind, Nash struggled with severe paranoid schizophrenia for two decades before recovering and winning a Nobel Prize for his earlier work on game theory, the mathematical study of decision-making. Everyone else would climb a peak by looking for a path somewhere on a mountain, required one former colleague. Nash would climb another mountain altogether, and from a distant peak would shine a searchlight back on the first peak. Nash, who was killed along with his wife Alicia in a car crash in New Jersey, was born in Bluefield, West Virginia, said the Daily Telegraph. Known as Big Brains as a child, he first demonstrated his prodigious mathematical talent at age 14 when he tried, and succeeded, in proving for himself Fermat's theorem. After studying at what is now Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Nash won a scholarship to Princeton. One of his references simply read, "This man is a genius." At Princeton, Nash quickly developed a reputation for arrogance, said the Los Angeles Times. He seldom attended class, annoyed other students by incessantly whistling Bach fugues, and spent hours bicycling figure eights on the university's quadrangle. At age 21, Nash wrote his groundbreaking thesis. Whereas previous game theory was based on the assumption that one party's loss was always the adversary's gain, Nash found ways to compute a sweet spot, the Nash equilibrium, where each party gets the best deal possible under the circumstances. The Nash equilibrium is now used to underpin everything from nuclear arms talks to contract negotiations in major league sports. After receiving his doctorate in 1950, Nash worked as a consultant to Rand Corporation and as an instructor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, said the New York Times. But as his career flourished, his personal life became increasingly complex. He had a son after a turbulent romance in Boston with a nurse, and was sacked from Rand after being arrested in a police sting to catch homosexuals. After he married Alicia, an MIT physics major in 1957, his mind began to unravel. He arrived at one party wearing nothing but a diaper and spent hours sitting on his wife's lap drinking from a baby bottle filled with bourbon and milk. As his paranoid schizophrenia worsened, he told colleagues aliens were communicating with him via coded messages in the Times, and he believed he was, among other things, the left foot of God, a Japanese shogun, and the future emperor of Antarctica. "I started to see crypto-communist everywhere," he recalled. "The delirium was like a dream from which I seemed never to awake." Alicia divorced Nash in 1963, but continued to care for him during his illness, said The Guardian. She took him in when he could no longer stand being treated in hospitals and arranged for him to spend his spare time in Princeton. Eventually, against all odds, Nash's symptoms wore off, something he attributes to his own decision to think rationally. He resumed his studies and in 1994 shared the Nobel Prize with two fellow game theory pioneers. In 2001, the mathematician remarried his ex-wife. Nash's story wasn't only about the mystery of the human mind, wrote his biographer, Sylvia Nasser. It was also a love story, a very grown-up love story. And a second obituary, the globetrotter who dazzled with his dribbling. Marquez Haynes, 1926 to 2015. For more than five decades, Marquez Haynes astonished audiences around the world with his incredible ball-handling skills. A standout member of the Harlem Globetrotters and other barnstorming black basketball teams, Haynes could dribble the ball three times in 1 second, bounce it above his head or an inch off the floor, and keep up the act while lying on his back, side, or stomach. The magazine Boy's Life described one 1968 performance when Haynes was 41, that saw him run around rival players, dribbling high and low, quickly and slowly, on his knees and sitting, seeking out victims and conquering them. In 22 seconds, he dribbled 57 times before driving in and sinking a layup. Born to a poor family in Sand Springs, Oklahoma, Haynes learned basketball from his three older siblings, said the New York Times. We'd take economy-sized food cans and cut the bottoms out and tack them to the outhouse, he said. Then ball rags and tie them together and shoot baskets. A star player on Langston University's basketball team, Haynes joined the Globetrotters after graduating in 1947. Although the Globetrotters were becoming known for their jokey routines, the squad often appeared in no-nonsense games against professional teams. In 1948 and 49, Haynes led the Globetrotters to victories over the all-white Minneapolis Lakers, the team that went on to capture the first ever NBA title in 1950, said the DallasNews.com. Those wins proved we were not only good comedians, Haynes said, but good ball players. Haynes left the Globetrotters in 1953 following a salary dispute and started his own team, the Harlem Magicians. For nearly 20 years, Haynes was the owner, coach, bus driver, and star attraction of the Magicians, the Globetrotters' chief rival in basketball comedy, said the Washington Post. He returned to the Globetrotters in 1972, but was dismissed in 1979 for trying to organize a players' union. Haynes continued to show off his dribbling in exhibitions around the world and finally retired at 71 after appearing in an estimated 12,500 games in 106 countries. He said he had no regrets about not playing in the NBA. As far as ability was concerned, I never doubted my ability against any of them, he said in 2007. I never had any reason to. And we turn now to our in-depth article, The Last Word. This one titled, You Too Can Be King. Want to be addressed as Your Royal Highness? Said Jennifer Parker. Just set up your own micronation. The email was signed Regards His Excellency, President Kevin Baugh, Republic of Malaysia. Come again? No, you're not forgetting your ex-Soviet bloc geography. Malaysia is not on any world map. But what does exist, everything a country has, Baugh assertive in his missive, a bank, a post office, a railroad, and an active navy, you'll find on a dusty sagebrush-pocked sliver of Nevada desert. It's a sovereign, independent nation as far as His Excellency is concerned. and a bizarre, strange lark to everyone else. Welcome to the world of micronations, where anyone can be a benevolent dictator. There was even a conference in April, the first in the actual U.S. of A., dubbed MicroCon 2015. It was held amid chalkboards and school chairs in a public rec room of Anaheim, California Central Library. Ball brought together 40 of the world's most preeminent dignitaries of countries you've never heard of to tend to matters of state as avidly as Disney's Imagineers tend to Mickey down the road. Leaders dressed up in their military best and browsed the table displays of royal regalia. The highlight, attendees agreed, was a choreographed battle performed by the Lamia Knights, a nonprofit team of amateur medieval sword fighters in the name of the Kingdom of Shiloh. It's exactly what you think. Grown men in chainmail role-playing in the middle of a public library. By all reports, it was a hoot. We wanted to come together, share our issues and successes, and get to know each other, just like the United Nations, said His Royal Highness Travis McHenry, Grand Duke of West Arctica. By definition, a micronation is any entity, physical or virtual, that purports to be a sovereign state, but you know, actually isn't. Micronations do not enjoy diplomatic recognition, but that doesn't stop them from trying. Almost all of MicroCon's leaders have written letters to their home governments requesting it. These people still want to be Americans. They just want to be Americans on their own terms, said researcher Stephen S. Scharf, who broke down the origins of micronations and their appeal in modern times in an inspirational keynote address delivered to the conference via YouTube. The Nevada-based shipping clerk has been a student of the micronations movement since the 1990s, when learning about the Vatican and the actual UN post office ignited his interest in the whole countries within countries concept. According to Scharf, MicroCon's attendees are mostly peaceful, independent dreamers who get a kick out of printing their own stamps and minting their own money and ruling over their own tiny slivers of private property. He describes the current phenomenon as a big fantasy role-playing game that involves a lot of self-aggrandizement. Yet micronational leaders haven't always been so innocuous. The very first micronation, according to Scharf's research, was the Upware Republic Society, which began as an exercise in fantasy way back in 1851. It was a literary group of Cambridge students who appointed themselves clerics and consuls and followed Samuel Butler, author of the science fiction novel Erewhon, an anagram for nowhere. It wasn't until the 1960s that the first territorial micronations, those aiming to establish new physical spaces, began to take root. For the Republic of Rose Island, founded in 1968, it didn't turn out so well. Italian Giorgio Rosa issued stamps and declared himself president of a floating platform in the Adriatic, all in a bid to draw visitors. But almost as soon as it was built, the Italian Navy took dynamite to his dreams for failure to pay taxes. In 1970, Australian farmer Leonard Casley used his personal property as a stage to protest the government's wheat quotas. By declaring the Principality of Hutt River independent, he didn't get out of paying taxes, but his farm soon became a tourist attraction. Residents of Key West, Florida, enacted a similarly cheeky secession in 1982 to protest a U.S. Border Patrol roadblock that was meant to stem an influx of Cuban immigrants. Although the Conch Republic was never legally recognized, its moniker still exists as a souvenir-selling curiosity today. By the 1990s, the Internet's democratizing force made it easier to create virtual micronations where anti-establishment eccentrics planted flags based on political protest. Almost half the countries of MicroCon's attendees, such as the Kingdom of Hamland, exist solely on the Internet and are difficult to differentiate from other social networks or message boards. Today, about 98 active micronations litter the globe from Australia to Antarctica. An unrelated international convention, Polynation, will take place later this year within the Free Republic of Alcatraz, a 500-acre micronation founded outside Perugia, Italy, by the son of Nobel laureate Dario Fo. Micronational movements even have their own archive file at the U.S. State Department, kept by the Office of the Geographer. It's called the Ephemeral Nations File and consists mainly of micronations' petitions for diplomatic recognition and the office's subsequent rejection letters. So what keeps these leaders going? Underneath the status flags and shiny coins, three threads appear to run through the phenomenon. Self-aggrandizement, yes, Your Grace. Creative self-expression, flag and costume design, and or passion for a cause, as with the Kingdom of Uberstadt, a socialist micronation in Washington State's Puget Sound region, whose five citizens attempt to buck U.S. capitalism by growing their own food, dyeing their own textiles, and harvesting natural medicines. Micronational leaders have neither actual celebrity nor regal wealth, so they're grabbing attention in the most official, self-important way possible, by running their own countries. It's Renaissance Fair meets Model UN with a hefty dose of political theory. And if you ask them, it's also fun. As Scharf eloquently said in his MicroCon 2015 keynote, dreamers and poets will always build castles in the sky, but only fools and lunatics will try to live in them. A micronation sampling. The Republic of Malaysia. Reason for being? Hobbyist tourism. The Republic of Malaysia sits on a 1.3-acre lot east of Reno, Nevada, that President Baugh purchased in 1998. Its bank is a wooden hut, which doesn't safeguard real money, but rather houses a stash of valora, a so-called currency made of poker chips. Its post office doesn't circulate real mail, but its mail mannequin postmaster, Fred, sits ready just in case. Its railroad is a toy railroad, and the active navy consists of Malaysia citizenry, Ball's 27 family members, taking kayak expeditions on Lake Tahoe with squirt guns. You, too, can tour Malaysia, or even join its navy if you call ahead and give Ball 2 weeks' notice. We're inspired to a certain extent by theme parks, but there's no real profit in having your own country, said Ball, who works full-time in human resources and doesn't charge visitors any immigration fees. But why? Why not? You just want to have your own country, like Little Caesar. In a commanding blue-green sash and full medals of questionable honored jacket, the benevolent dictator is the embodiment of the self-reflective satire endemic to most micronations. West Arctica. The reason for being? Nonprofit awareness. To meet the enterprising leader of West Arctica, you'd have to travel to West Hollywood, California, where he works as a recruiter for a media company and advocates for climate change awareness. To reach the actual country, 620,000 frozen, uninhabitable square miles of western Antarctica, you'd need a boat and a really good reason. Think climatology research, penguin films. I've never been there myself, but we want to occupy that region, said Grand Duke McHenry, who founded the country, population 300, in 2001, when he noticed the land hadn't been claimed by legitimized nations. McHenry registered West Arctica as a nonprofit in 2014 and nationalized citizens who electronically pledge allegiance to freedom with the goal of creating a new country in the frigid ice of Antarctica, and sign up for his newsletter. Custom-made metal and wooden West Arctican coins might have no real value, other than the U.S. dollars they might garner from curious collectors on eBay, but the Grand Duke hopes their sale will eventually allow him to colonize. If we put people there permanently, we'll have a better platform to advocate for that melting ice, said McHenry. The Ambulatory Free States of Obsidia. Reason for being, political art. You won't need a passport to visit Obsidia. You'll just need to track down Carolyn Yagjian, the Grand Marshal of this mobile nation. A 29-year-old visual artist from Oakland, she resents the fact that most micronations are male-dominated monarchies. So when she found a volcanic obsidian rock on a hiking trail in California, she declared a matriarchal micronation and made the rock its mobile embassy. I've always been attracted to the idea of statehood, said Yagjian, and this is an opportunity to question a lot of things people accept about as normal about national identity. Her nation rock, unveiled in a bright blue and hot pink suitcase, wasn't considered typical even by microcon standards. But she won a lot of points for her feminist chutzpah and general creativity. I'll allow men to become citizens, but I don't want them to have places in government, added the Grand Marshal, who chose her title more for its authoritarian ring than for its textbook leader of a military state meaning. So far, Obsidia is a fake matriarchy of one, but it's got 63 likes and counting on its Facebook page. Microcon 2015 attendees. Kingdom of Ruritania. Ruritania is 0.34 acres in the U.S. state of Georgia, but Queen Anastasia calls it an absolute monarchy based on divine right. The Kingdom of Slabovia. Slabovia is an online micronation that lays claim to 300 acres on Mars. Its official sport is Slabovian rules chess. It's basically chess. Provisional Territories of the FART, standing for Free Autocratic Republic of Totalitarianism, this cybernation's founding mission is world domination. It has no claim to land, but its national insect is the jumping spider. The Kingdom of Vikesland. Another cyber micronation, Vikesland has its own online souvenir shop and broadcasting channel, YouTube, dedicated to videos about micronations. Royal Republic of Ladonia. Ladonia lays claim to two standing sculptures made by driftwood on a small rocky shore stretching less than half a mile in the Kullaberg National Nature Reserve in southern Sweden. West Who. This online micronation's capital city is Whoville. The group makes its own stamps, and anyone can become a citizen. Kingdom of Shiloh. This virtual micronation is home to a nonprofit sports team of amateur medieval-style sword fighters called the Lamia Knights. Yan. This online micronation is made up of one guy with a YouTube video who streams photos of himself set to techno music. Grand Duchy of Broslavia. Broslavia is located in Albuquerque. It is an absolute monarchy ruled by His Majesty Grand Duke Jacob Feltz. Empire of Gilead. Its location is Rio Rancho, New Mexico, is unverified, but its motto, Valar Morghulis, is definitely cribbed from the Game of Thrones. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Bloomberg.com. We'll take in one of the book reviews this week. Their book of the week is called Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. Elon Musk is about as close as we have, circa 2015, to early industrial titans like Henry Ford, Andrew Carnegie, and John D. Rockefeller, said Dwight Garner in the New York Times. In an era when American innovators mostly limit themselves to creating internet clickbait, the Silicon Valley billionaire continues to dream big. Musk's companies, Tesla and SpaceX, have realized two of his visions: high-performance electric cars and private space flight, and he's still working on providing humanity with the capacity to colonize Mars. The Musk we meet in Ashley Vance's well-calibrated new biography isn't cuddly. At 43, he's been married three times and retains a nanny manager to orchestrate the care of his five children. But he does display smarts as well as swagger. Many more books will eventually be written about Musk. Vance's is easily the richest to date. No wonder Robert Downey Jr. based his portrayal of Tony Stark on Tesla's founder, said Philip Delves Broughton in the Wall Street Journal. Musk presents himself, seemingly without trying, as a man arrived from the future to generously bestow on us, the people of Earth, his vision and gifts. His actual life story began in South Africa, where as a boy he was terrorized by schoolyard bullies and a stern father. He immigrated to Canada at 11, earned dual Ivy League degrees, then headed for Silicon Valley, where he netted $22 million from the sale of a software startup. Next came his work at PayPal, whose 2002 sale gave Musk the $165 million that he's applied to his flashier ventures. Rocket scientists at established companies such as Lockheed Martin initially laughed at his ambitions for SpaceX, but later, many decided to join him. At Tesla Motors, Musk's scrappy team tested how wintry conditions would affect the prototypes by shutting them inside a used ice cream delivery truck. It's a nice tale, but it deserves some scrutiny, said Kevin Canfield in San Francisco Chronicle. Vance, a Bloomberg Businessweek reporter, does make room for the gripes of Musk's rivals and some ex-employees, including one who says the boss berated him for missing work to attend the birth of his child. Musk denied this in a recent Twitter post. Yet the author mostly lionizes his subject, buying Musk's claim that from an early age he accepted personal responsibility for trying to rescue humanity from ruin. But maybe the source of Musk's drive doesn't matter as much as where it's led. Whatever his motivations, there's no denying he's achieving amazing things. On the health and science page, honeybee deaths rising. Colony collapse disorder, the mysterious decade-long die-off among honeybees, is getting worse. A survey of about 5,000 beekeepers in the U.S. has found that they've lost about 42% of the colonies over just the past year. Even more alarming is the fact that honeybee deaths spiked in the summer when bees are usually healthiest. What we're seeing with this bee problem is just a loud signal that there's some bad things happening with our agro-ecosystems, the study's co-author Keith Delaplane tells the Washington Post. The die-off probably has multiple causes, researchers say. Millions of acres of land once filled with wildflowers have been plowed and planted with corn and soybeans, reducing the bees' pollen supply and causing some to starve. Bees are also falling prey to a deadly parasite called the varroa mite. Pesticides widely used in the U.S., particularly neonicotinoids, disrupt bees' nervous systems and probably also play a role. Bees are not in danger of extinction because beekeepers respond to die-offs by splitting their surviving colonies and starting new ones. But these smaller and weaker colonies produce less honey, and push bees to their limits. About one-third of all plants or plant products people consume rely on bee pollination, including nuts, produce, cotton, and coffee. Ancient boiling oceans. In its early days, Earth became hell. About 3.3 billion years ago, new research indicates at least two massive asteroids, 30 to 60 miles in diameter, smashed into this planet, boiling the oceans and sending atmospheric temperatures soaring to an unimaginable 932 degrees Fahrenheit. Stanford University scientists have found evidence of this extreme era in a geological formation in South Africa called the Barberton Greenstone Belt, which is riddled with telltale round spheres of silica, rock that was molten and flung skyward and then settled back to Earth. The energy from the asteroid impacts, researchers say, made Earth so hot that oceans boiled for a year, with evaporation dropping sea levels by about 328 feet. The cataclysmic events on ancient Earth likely had a dramatic effect on the evolution of the primitive life forms then in existence. They'd keep getting whacked by these giant impactors and driven to extinction or near extinction, the study's leader Don Lowe tells ScienceNews.org. Scientists say deep sea dwellers and bacteria that thrive in heat, known as thermophiles, may have been the main survivors. And the health scare of the week: working while everyone else is sleeping takes a serious toll on a person's health. Clocking into work nights or irregular and rotating shifts is associated with more stress and unhealthy lifestyle habits, such as being sedentary and following an unhealthy diet, which can lead to diabetes, heart disease, and other chronic health issues, new research reveals. Scientists found that people working nights or extended hours ate more fat and fewer fruits and vegetables than those who work days, a difference that can lead to weight gain. A separate study also found shift workers are more likely to be overweight, struggle with insomnia, and get insufficient sleep on a regular basis, MedicalDaily.com reports. Scientists warn that not getting enough sleep also heightens the risk for metabolic disorders, including obesity and diabetes. The most important message to shift workers, says researcher Katri Hemio, is that they should be aware of increased risk for chronic disease and that healthy nutrition may lower the risk. On the Talking Points page, Josh Duggar, The Fall of an Evangelical Hero. Until last week, Josh Duggar was a socially conservative icon, said Elizabeth Dias in Time.com. The eldest son of an evangelical Christian family featured in the reality TV show 19 and Counting, Duggar, 27, parlayed his fame into a leadership position at the Family Research Council, a Christian lobbying group, and a prominent role in national conservative politics. He served as an advisor to Mike Huckabee's 2008 presidential campaign, and his endorsement has been sought after by nearly all the 2016 GOP presidential candidates, as well as dozens of senators, representatives, and governors. But last week, In Touch Weekly revealed that Duggar had sexually molested at least five young girls when he was 15, including his own sisters. Duggar's father, a former Arkansas state legislator, dealt with the abuse at the time by making Duggar talk to church elders and a state trooper. Duggar has now acknowledged he acted inexcusably and has resigned from Family Research Council. Meanwhile, TLC has stopped airing 19 and Counting. So kids got molested and Josh basically got off with a warning, said Hemant Mehta in Pathos.com. Pretty ironic, given that he and his council have been warning for years that gay men are likely to be pedophiles and that gay marriage endangers children. Incredibly, Huckabee is among those who have leaped to Duggar's defense, saying his actions were inexcusable, but not unforgivable. Spare me all the liberal outrage, said Jeannie DeAngelis in AmericanThinker.com. The left enthusiastically encourages all manner of sexual experimentation by teens and still worships an ex-president who preyed on a White House intern and was accused by multiple women of sexual assault. This is only a national story because the Duggars dare to advocate for abstinence and defend traditional marriage. The Duggars' belief in their son's behavior are not unrelated, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate.com. Homeschooled and cloistered from the outside world, Duggar and his siblings grew up in a cult. His parents are part of the Christian patriarchy movement, which commands total female submission to men. The Duggars have even forbidden their adult daughters to kiss or hold hands before marriage. Duggar was brainwashed with this misogynistic dogma from an early age, so is it any surprise he indulged his power over females? He deserves scorn, but also a small measure of our pity. And another Talking Points article, Obamacare, why Republicans fear victory. A wave of panic over Obamacare is spreading through the Republican ranks, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. In June, the U.S. Supreme Court may drive a stake through the Affordable Care Act by cutting off critical insurance subsidies to nearly 8 million Americans, triggering painful blowback for the GOP. The legal issue in King v. Burwell hinges on a technical drafting error in the ACA that says subsidies will be provided to people who buy insurance on exchanges established by the state. Since 37 states decided not to set up exchanges, letting the federal government run them instead, the five conservative justices could decide to cut off subsidies in those states, making health insurance suddenly unaffordable. That supposed triumph over Obamacare could leave GOP senators and governors facing two unpalatable choices. They can surrender and amend the law, or set up state exchanges after all, enraging the conservative base. Or they can let the court's ruling stand and be blamed when horror stories emerge of people with cancer, diabetes, and other conditions losing their medical care. This doesn't have to be a friendly fire massacre for Republicans, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. If the court overturns the subsidies, the GOP should back Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson's proposal to extend subsidies for those already enrolled in Obamacare through August 2017. In return, Johnson would strip the ACA of Obamacare's central planning dictates, including the individual mandate that everyone have insurance or pay a penalty. If Obama vetoes the proposal, then it will be his fault when people lose their subsidies. Most Americans aren't interested in legislative minutiae, said Jeffrey Toobin in NewYorker.com. So if millions lose insurance, they'll hold it against Obamacare and against Obama. The president and the legislation have become inextricably linked. If coverage suddenly becomes unaffordable for any reason, the buck will stop with him. Obama has already said he would veto any Republican bill that undermines the ACA's core provisions, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. Many conservative House Republicans, meanwhile, say they won't support Johnson's bill because it represents a continuation of Obamacare. So if the court decides to end subsidies in 37 states, chaos is likely to result, while Obama and Congress play a high-stakes game of chicken to see who gives in first. This could get very ugly. And a few short notes as we wind down the hour. Drivers are doing more than just texting behind the wheel. In a new study by Braun Research, 33% admitted they regularly send and read emails while driving, while 28% said they browse the internet, and 27% said they use Facebook. Same-sex marriages are now allowed in 20 countries around the world, but in 66 countries, homosexual acts are still illegal. And in 12 countries, including Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia, they are punishable by death. The U.S.-led air operation against the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria cost American taxpayers more than $2.1 billion as of early April, or about $8.6 million per day, according to the latest Pentagon figures. Allied warplanes have carried out more than 4,050 attacks in Iraq and Syria. The oldest person in the world, Geraldine Talley of Michigan, turned 116 last week. The two oldest persons ever known to science, Sarah Knaus of Pennsylvania and Jean Calment of France, reached 119 and 122 respectively. A campaign to allow students and teachers to carry guns at public colleges so they can fire back at mass shooters or defend themselves against sexual assault is failing in 14 out of 15 states where bills have been introduced. Only in Texas does the legislation have a chance of passing this year. On the poll watch, 31% of Americans describe their views on social issues as liberal, matching the number who identify themselves as conservatives for the first time, as social conservatives. Last year, 34% identified as social conservatives, and 30% considered themselves social liberals. And a quote from Henry David Thoreau, quoted in the Boston Herald, "Many men go fishing all of their lives without knowing that it is not fish they are after." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.